welcome back. Anyway, happy January 19th. I have no shadows today to show off to you, and it's nice that we can come. If there's space available, if you have a shadow, they're welcome to sit by you at the table. If there's room, if there's not, they'll understand. But it's I think it's so exciting to see youth get involved in government, and so we want to encourage that sort of thing. I think there were like 25 students in that school here yesterday. anyway, let's do the minutes. Representative Lohmer, I think we'd like to move the minutes just so she doesn't get left out of her fraternity over there, or sorority. Thanks. Any discussion about the minutes? All those in favor say aye. 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 Opposed? Aye. Okay, thanks. There, be done with that. okay, today we're going to take up, we're doing a bill at the end of the hour. The agenda is correct about that, and then we're going to, in the meantime, continue going into some monetary depth. The testifiers can come up, Ms. Rankin, if you're running that, or who's ever going to be getting your stuff going while we... okay. Ms. Jones, if you want to come up. Well, you're just keeping an eye on things, Ms. Rankin. Okay. And we allowed an hour or so for the whole presentation, and so if we want to have some time for discussion about the bill at the end, and I think that would probably be ample, 35 minutes or so, to cover the testifiers and the content of it. So anyway, welcome to the committee, and just so you know what we're trying to do, Mr. Hoffman termed this work fiscal immersion, which I appreciated the humor of that kind of comment. So. To go through every element of your department would take us until a year from August, and help us understand. We've already been through the forecast. Most members don't have it memorized, but at least they're familiar with it, and we've been going through. And so you can, I know you have a presentation in place. So if you have handouts, and just point out which one you're on and what pages you're on, and that helps us too. So thank you. Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representatives, I'm Connie Jones. I'm the Acting Chief Administrative Officer and the HR Director for the Department of Human Services. And financial operations is somewhat unique as it provides both agency-wide operational support, such as IT, management services, HR, as well as direct program services. I'll provide a really brief overview of FMO operations, followed by a more detailed review of the FMO direct care or direct program services from the leads from licensing, appeals, and parental fees. So DHS administers the state's human service programs, such as health care, economic assistance, child welfare, services for people with disabilities, and direct care services, such as those provided by state-operated services. Programs are administered by five major areas within the agency. So if you turn to the org chart that is in the packet, just review those quickly. In the far left-hand side, there's chemical and mental health services. That includes all DHS behavioral health policy areas. Are you able to find that? Don't have them?
Oh, we have that from...
You do, okay.
Yeah, we have it. Had it yesterday. I hope that you kept it. If not, we can get you another one.
Okay.
Thanks.
It includes all DHS behavioral health policy areas, including the adult mental health, children's mental health, and chemical health divisions, and state-operated services, which does provide the direct care services. Children and Family Services helps keep children and families safe. Health care oversees Minnesota health care programs, eligibility and benefit policies. Continuing care works to ensure quality care and services for seniors and other adults who need help living as independently as possible. And then you have financial operations. We really are the function that provides the operational support for all of those program areas. Approximately 97% of the DHS budget is for program expenditures, such as provider payments to hospitals or nursing homes. And approximately 3% of that budget is for the central office administration. Central office administration includes FMO and those major program areas on the organizational chart. The FMO operations budget is $82 million with several funding streams. General fund is the primary funding source, though. But I want to note that of the $82 million, 21% of that number is for lease costs, which is about $18 million. FMO's full-time equivalent positions is 570.8, and the majority of those positions are funded, again, from the general fund and provide both operational support and direct program support. And then FMO is organized into a number of offices, each with specialized areas, and that would be on this handout that says Finance and Management Operations on the top. And if you turn to the back, it lists really the core functions of the Financial Management Operations Division. Examples on the chart then include the IT, strategic planning, and support functions such as desktop support and help desk, managing agency servers and the system security. Facility management such as security, space planning, and building maintenance. The agency procurement. The financial services such as accounting, budgeting, payroll, accounts receivable, and accounts payable. And human resources including the workforce planning, recruitment, labor relations, training, contract administration, safety and health, and business continuity. Overall, FMO provides the type of administrative support functions you'd find in any other large agency or any business. And the focus is to ensure the agency has the necessary support needed to effectively administer the state's human service program and serve the public. Any questions?
Keep going. Okay. Thanks.
Then let's turn our focus and review to the FMO program direct services, and Ann Berry, who is a deputy commissioner, will now present for DHS appeals and functions.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr.
Introduce
Chairman.
Introduce yourself, please. And,
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Ann Berry, and I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Services. However, up until 2 days ago, I was the Chief Compliance Officer for the Minnesota Department of Human Services, and that's why I'm making this presentation today. We've highlighted a couple of different sections from the Compliance Office. The first one we'll talk about is the Appeals and Regulations Division, and then Jerry Kerber will talk about the Licensing Division. And we've highlighted these for a number of reasons. First, in the appeals area, you'll get a lot of interest and questions from constituents about where clients' appeals may be in the process inside of the agency. And so to give you hopefully this overview will help you see how we operate in that area, and then if you have questions, how you can contact us inside the agency. Again, one of our core functions in the compliance office is to conduct hearings and issue final orders. We have almost 9,000 cases a year that are heard in the fair hearing process. These are heard by human services judges. The clients, providers all have due process rights. So if the department makes a decision that a client wants to challenge or a provider wants to challenge, they have the right to do so. They lodge that complaint or with the department, and the process begins. And then a decision is rendered, and either the department's position is sustained or it is not in favor of the client. You can see that these cases cut across all parts of the agency. So we have cases in medical assistance, in general assistance medical care, Minnesota Care. They run the entire gamut of the agency's services. That number has gone up. We're almost at 9,000 cases a year. A couple of years ago, we would have been about at 6,500 cases a year. Every time we see major legislative changes, we see an increase in the number of hearings and the number of actions that are brought by clients and providers, just because there are changes to those programs and because the clients have rights to bring those actions.
Ms. Berry, I know I should congratulate you on your the new position you have, too. So, well, you'll be here many times, I think, in your upcoming
I'll look
position.
Forward to that, Mr. Chairman.
When we make a change in licensing and all that sort of thing, do you, as part of the fiscal note, do you include a price for the hearings?
Mr.
Did you know they're coming?
Mr. Chairman, we include an overhead, an amount of overhead associated with legislative changes. And so I don't know how precise we are about the exact cost of appeals, but we're now paying closer attention to that, and particularly because of the changes in the personal care attendant program from the last couple of years. The number the increase in the number of cases that came with those changes were substantial. And we really hadn't accounted for all of those changes. We needed to redeploy some staff so that they could hear all of those cases. So we intend to pay even closer attention. But to answer the original question, there's an amount of included in the fiscal note that includes support for a number of different activities inside the agency.
And I don't know if it's part of your presentation, Ms. Berry, but maybe you can comment on how those PCA appeals are going and what, how many are upheld, and is that going to come up at a different day, or are we talking about that? Or
I don't,
Just give us a comment about it, and I know a lot of members were interested in this topic before.
Mr. Chairman, I think we could get on your agenda to talk a little specifically then about the appeals. We had, I don't think I'd be overstating it if I said thousands. Thousands of appeals from recipients receiving personal care services, and I'm not sure that we might be able to present a visual on what those cases looked like and what was the outcome of the cases.
Yeah, Ms. I think that would be productive at some point, because we spent some effort on that. It's an ongoing discussion. There's some changes coming up in July again that are on people's minds, and I don't know how we fit that in, but I know that it's something that we would want to talk about. So, thanks. And you can come back and either would that be you or someone else coming that time?
Mr. Chairman, that will probably be someone else.
Okay. Thanks.
Then to wrap up, I think some of the other activities inside the Appeals and Regulation Division, we also conduct maltreatment and disqualification hearings. We manage the contracts for the agency, professional technical contracts. We do the legal review for those contracts. We also maintain all the delegations of authority from the commissioner. There's almost 200 different delegations of authority that the commissioner has across the agency. And we assist in the rulemaking or rule writing process for staff inside the agency. The bottom of the page shows you that the amount that this costs for the amount of funds spent in this area are small in comparison to some of the other administrative functions inside the agency, but you can also see that it comes from different parts of the agency, both the general or funding sources, the general fund, the healthcare access fund, TANF, and the special revenue fund. And again, that those funds are in relationship to the kind of hearing that's being held and what kind of case we're reviewing.
And Ms. Berry, to that, so like the healthcare, if it's a Minnesota Care case, the defense, that comes out of the healthcare access fund?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. If it's a Minnesota Care appeal, we try to match that up with the healthcare access fund.
All right. Any questions about any of that? This is really quite interesting, so thanks. You can keep going.
Mr. Chairman, that's all I have. It's the third page in your handout. That's all I have. Jerry Kerber is here to talk about licensing.
We don't want to slow him down getting here for that.
Which generally generates many questions. If not, I have nothing else.
Any questions for Ms. Berry? And Representative Hosh, for instance, do you want to hear more about PCA stuff today or another time? I know that you were working a lot on this topic. About the appeals and all that, or are you?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think there's a lot on this agenda already, and I think with not only what's already happened with PCA services, but what is about to happen coming up July 1st, that we may need more time. But if you want to do...
Well, I'll see how this presentation goes at the end, because I'm trying to... I have more regard for Representative Huntley every day, as he'd had to juggle all the topics that to get through here. And so if we overestimated the time, then maybe we'll come back, and okay. Yeah, there'd be a good discussion to have while the Assistant Deputy Commissioner is. So don't leave just yet. But Mr. Kerber, welcome back. A licensing day is a good day, I think, isn't it? This
pretty Thank much. You, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jerry Kerber from the Department of Human Services, where I'm the Director of the Licensing Division. And on the back of your handout, there are some summary information about licensing, and I'll generally go through this. We are within the Department of Human Services. We have about 123 employees who perform a variety of licensing functions. They generally fall into three areas. We do licensing of programs, we do maltreatment investigations, and we do background studies, and I'll talk about each of those separately. As it relates to licensing, we license about 24,000 programs throughout the state. And those would include, as you can see here, chemical dependency treatment programs, mental health, treatment programs, adult day services, child care centers, children's residential facilities, and any of the services for people with developmental disabilities that are licensed. Those are the services that we license directly, as we call it, using state employees. And we have about 30 state employees who perform those functions. And that means they process applications and do all the site inspections. And we do about, there's about 4,000 of those programs, and we do about 2,000 site inspections a year and investigate between 450 and 500 complaints a year. Out of those, we end up issuing about 200 sanctions a year against those programs. The other group, the other licensing model that we operate under is through our county partnership. And so through the county partnership that we have, we license another 20,000 programs, and those are family child care providers, child foster care, adult foster care, and family adult day services. And out in the counties, there are about 575 licensing staff performing a variety of these activities. And in those programs, we issue about 600 licensing sanctions a year. We also do maltreatment investigations, and investigations, as I meant, complaint investigations I mentioned earlier, but we also do maltreatment investigations. And our maltreatment intake area receives about 4,500 complaints and reports a year related to licensed programs. And we end up investigating about 900 of those as possible maltreatment. And we do those investigations under the Vulnerable Adult Act or under the Maltreatment of Minors Act, the same as the health department and the same as county adult and child protection. And of those maltreatment investigations, we tend to substantiate maltreatment in about 25% of the cases. And in those cases, about when we substantiate, about 70% of the time, we find that an individual was responsible for the maltreatment versus the facility. Under the maltreatment statutes, when we investigate an allegation of maltreatment and we determine that it happened and that it meets the elements of the definitions of maltreatment, then the next step for us is to determine whether or not an individual is responsible or whether the facility was responsible. If the facility was responsible, we'll probably issue a fine. If an individual is responsible, we review the substantiated maltreatment to determine whether or not, under the background study law, that individual should be disqualified. And so we end up disqualifying about 60 people a year for substantiated maltreatment from the investigations we complete. And overall, of all of our maltreatment investigations, about 10% of our investigations result in a disqualification of an individual for maltreatment. The third area is our background study area, and we do quite a few of these. We do, last year we did about 263,000. It's over 1,000 a day now, and we're doing them on the people who work in programs licensed by the Department of Human Services. We do them on people who work in programs that are licensed by the Department of Health, and we do them on some people who are working in programs licensed by the Department of Corrections. In all three of those cases, in those other cases, we have contracts with those agencies, and we also do them on PCA service providers. And all told, we end up disqualifying about 12,000 people a year from those background studies, and we do that all according to the background study law. So that's kind of what we do. We have an $11.2 million annual budget, and about 6.4 of that is general fund money, and about $1 million is federal funds, and about 3.8 of it is from a variety of other sources, including background study revenue that we collect. So I can answer any questions or try anyway.
Yeah, you have one so far. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Kerber, when we've heard before about some of the electronic licensing renewals, some of that, there was a fair amount of discussion last time about that. So might you give an update on that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Kiffmeyer, that's the e-licensing project. It was part of the Drive to Excellence initiative. And initially, there were two agencies that were that were the pilot agencies when the project was funded by the legislature. Those two agencies were the Post Board and EMS, Emergency Medical Services Responders. Then as the project moved into the next phase where it was going to be funded through a surcharge on licensing fees collected by state agencies and the licensing boards, the Department of Human Services is the first agency in this phase of that project. And so we're coming up close on going live. We've been working on this for about a year now, and our target date is Valentine's Day. I don't think that's significant, but it's the middle of February. And in the middle of February is when we are hoping to hit the switch so that we can start doing some licensing transitions with counties. As I mentioned, there are about 575 county licensing employees out there. And the way it works is counties complete reviews of applications, and they do site visits, and they do complaint investigations, and they issue correction orders. But if it comes to recommending that a program be licensed or recommending a licensing sanction, they make that recommendation to the commissioner, and then we issue that action. Many of these transactions that we're doing with counties now are on paper, and this e-licensing system is going to allow those counties in the first phase to engage in those activities. That business with us will be online, and so it'll be much more efficient on our end especially. And the next phase of it then will be where license holders in our directly licensed programs will be able to apply for a license for some of them, and child care centers will be able to apply. But at any rate, everybody will be able to renew their licenses online and pay their licensing fees. And that's probably, you know, within the next year, that part of it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. That was a good update. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kerber, I'm a licensed daycare provider myself, so I know, you know, the licensing issues that we have. I wouldn't say issues, just paperwork. If I want to use a person that's already gone through the background clearance that's a licensed foster care provider and I want to use them as a backup provider in my home, they still have to go through the same exact paperwork to get a background check just to be in my daycare home. Is there any way that there can be combined so that the same paperwork isn't having to be filled? I mean, it is kind of an annoyance to some of my people that have just, you know, they have it on file already.
Mr. Chair and Representative Franzen, when I was describing the background study system, one more bit of detail about that is that while we do all of those background studies, the one area where we don't yet do background studies is in family child care. The background studies are done in that area, but those are still done by the counties. There have been bills in each of the last three legislative sessions to move that background study function from counties to the state, and I think you're going to see that bill again. And when that happens, I think, Representative Franzen, there will be a lot more transferability that we can design into the system. We're trying to decrease the number of times we do a background study on the same person, certainly, for many reasons. And so I think, you know, when that bill comes up, we're going to make, hopefully, take some steps to make sure that they are more transferable in that way.
Is that enough? Well, I have a question on the same line of questioning on the child care. The counties licensed the homes. Licensed homes. Is that right, Mr. Kerber?
Mr. Chair, the counties do inspections. The counties process applications, do inspections, follow up on complaints. The license is actually issued by the state.
Oh. Okay. And so there's talk about the cost of that for the counties. They bring this up, and you're well aware of the discussion. What does it cost you to license a Rule 3 center? Do you have any idea?
Well, Mr. Chair, our cost, I don't have it off the top of my head, but I can get that information. I know that our licensing fees, you know, we collect the licensing fee that is deposited into the general fund. And as it relates to child care centers, we don't collect quite enough funds to actually recover the cost of licensing. It's close, but it's not quite there. And so those fees 10 for a smaller program, I think is $225 a year, and it kind of goes up. It's on a scale based on the capacity of the program. Right. So I don't know specifically what it costs per year, but I can get that for you.
Well, and I'm just kind of interested in the whole topic. And the counties say that it is inspecting the homes and so on is they get $50, or is that what it is? They get something below their costs, and that's a concern in tight budget times. And some people say we should just make them pay the whole cost, which would be kind of a big jump. And so do you have a comment? Yeah. One of the licensed home providers I know just expressed their concern about that question. But I'm just telling you, Ibsen, it's come up as a discussion point. So since Mr. Kerber's here, I'm asking about that. So do you want to comment about that, too?
Mr. Chair, I think for many years there was a prohibition in the law related to counties charging a fee for licensing activities. That changed a number of years ago, and I'm sure Representative Slavik remembers this. And so counties were allowed to begin charging a fee for not only the licensing inspection, but also for the background studies that they're performing. And so I think initially the licensing fee was $100 and the background study fee was $150 per year. And then in subsequent years, I think a bill was introduced that reduced that fee the counties could charge and capped it at $50 a year or $100 for 2 years. I've heard from counties that they don't believe that's really enough to recover their costs, but at the same time, the whole issue gets complicated a little bit by the fact that not every county is charging a fee because it's discretionary. And so some counties don't charge and some charge the full amount. And so, you know, it gets to be kind of complicated in the discussion. There was a report to the legislature a number of years ago from DHS that sort of kind of outlined what was going on throughout the state.
All right, that's helpful. As long as you're here, just can you compare just off the we didn't prepare you for these questions, but you come and I start thinking of things that come up. You talked about maltreatment complaints and so on, and there's quite a few licensed homes. Do you get a lot of maltreatment complaints coming out of those, or many?
Mr. Chair, we get, as I mentioned, we investigate about 900 alleged incidents of maltreatment or incidents of alleged maltreatment every year, and so we get about 4,500 complaints of all sorts that is reduced down to about 900 that get investigated as possible maltreatment. And when you talk about in homes, I'm not sure, Mr. Chair, if you're referring to family child care. In family child care and child foster care, the county child protection still does those investigations. And in any other DHS licensed program, our office would do those maltreatment investigations.
All right. Is there data on, are those reported centrally, like the county investigations, and how many allegations and how many were substantiated by provider types?
Mr. Chair, for family child care, I can probably get you that data, yes.
And we're trying to decide what this revolves around is we're trying to look at everything. Mm-hmm. We have Rule 3 centers that are highly credentialed, and you watch them pretty tightly too. And I'd be interested just to know how they compare. They're all caring places, you know, and they screen their employees, I know. And I'm just curious about the incidents from one compared to the other. And and so, if there's a legal unlicensed home, then that'd be they probably don't get reported much, do they? I suppose if they're legal unlicensed, the county would be involved if there were. But they would. Those probably aren't tracked as closely, right?
Mr. Chair, the legal non-licensed providers, or kith and kin, I think they're called sometimes, family, friends, and neighbors sometimes, there's a lot less known about them, of course, and unless they are, if they're receiving child care assistance, then they're registered. But when you get out into that real informal care arrangement between a parent and a neighbor or a parent and a family member, that isn't licensed and isn't required to be licensed, you know, there's a lot less known about what happens. With the licensed program, licensed family child care, of course, everybody's a mandated reporter, and they're required to have training and on maltreatment of minors and reporting requirements, and the phone number for making a report is printed on people's license, and they're required to give parents phone numbers for who to report to if they have any concerns of any kind. And so the system is a lot tighter with the license care, but and even though we don't do those maltreatment investigations, and I think I can probably get you the numbers for county child protection for those investigations.
Well, I think it's interesting, and we have a study group and have some friends in Slawick and two others. It was just four people on that one, right? And so Okay. We're just looking at a lot of things. So if you don't mind, that'd be great, sure. And get it to them and to me. Anybody else want to ask Mr. Kerber anything about licensing? Oh, Rep. Senator Franson.
And this is just a general comment about maltreatment in the child care homes, 4,400. I just want to say, as a provider, when these allegations are made, child care providers are always always guilty until proven innocent, which is extremely frustrating. Just coming from a provider, if something were, I've known complaints in the community that have happened, and you know, they're kind of shunned until it was proven it was just whatever, and it wasn't even a treatment. A parent could just get upset with the provider, and sometimes things are just blown out of proportion. I mean, there are some serious allegations out there. I've seen them, but just general statement that, you know, it is a tough job.
Do you want to comment?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative, I know that it probably feels that way to people. That's not really how the law is set up, of course. Things must be fully investigated, and there are a number of procedures in the Maltreatment of Minors Act that must be followed by the county or by our office if there's an investigation underway, including who gets notified of different things. And then there's also a pretty significant appeal process at the end. And I think we heard Ms. Ann Berry talk about the appeals division. That's one of the hearing types that they handle, is people appealing a maltreatment finding, either by the county or by us or by the health department. And so there are hopefully the notifications are all in order. And we see those from time to time, and give county's feedback when we see that the notifications aren't correct. But I'm sure it's troubling to be on the wrong end of a maltreatment investigation, I'm sure.
Mr. Kerber, is maybe this is something you can get a hold of him and talk as part of your study group. He's good to. Yeah, it's. I mean, you're in a difficult position. You have, you know, imminent harm or you know nothing. Is there kind of a hierarchy of like initial sanctions? If there's something trivial, then is it kept quiet? And then if it's something significant, there's a line that you have to above which you. There's a temporary closure pending an outcome. Can you just comment about that, too?
Mr. Chair, yes, and I think there were some fairly significant changes made to both the maltreatment statute and the background study law last year in your bill. There are different thresholds that have to be met. Certainly there are events that occur in any kind of license setting that are unpleasant, but that doesn't mean that they necessarily meet the threshold to be called maltreatment. The maltreatment definitions in both the Vulnerable Adult Act and the Maltreatment of Minors Act have some pretty clear standards that need to be met. The elements of the definitions are pretty clear. And where they haven't been clear, the legislature has worked over the last several years to make them more clear. And so to that point, last year there was a change to the Maltreatment of Minors Act. Let's see if I can get this straight. Things in child care in particular, it is only going to be neglect when they're, let me think for a sec. A lot of these definitions unfortunately depend on what happens, what's the outcome of if a child is injured. And so in child care, if there is a burn, for instance, of a child or an injury that requires only the type of care that's available over the counter, then it isn't necessarily maltreatment anymore. It was up until the changes last year. And then as it relates to disqualifications, if the medication that's ordered, it gets down to whether or not the care of a physician is required. If a child is injured to the extent that the care of a physician is required, then it's more likely going to be maltreatment. If there was a failure, also. But that's the threshold for harm. And It isn't going to be disqualifying maltreatment in every one of those cases, even. And the outlier is if there is a burn and there's an order of, for instance, Silvadine cream, which is very common for treating burns on children. And so even though it's available only under prescription, if that's what's ordered, it isn't necessarily disqualifying maltreatment. And so the laws aren't perfect, but there's been a lot of effort in the last several years to sort of identify some of those gradations of harm that are suffered as a result of a failure by somebody.
I think that's Representative Slawik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, just a comment. When we had the hearing yesterday and about how sensitive it is for sex offenders. In child care, the maltreatment issues are very, very sensitive. And we actually had one where we had a provider testifying last year, and it was over a child got their finger pinched in a door. And the provider, she was right there, but it's, you know, is that maltreatment? But it, because of everything, they did have to report it and so forth. I think Representative Murphy carried that bill. So there are a lot of issues that come up. I just had a question about inspections. We're having some issues on inspections. You know, they're only inspected every other year right now. How long ago did we do that? I can't exactly remember. And that was a financial issue, as I recall. And has there been any increase of maltreatment or other issues since we went to every other year inspections?
Mr. Kerber.
Mr. Chair and Representative Slawik, there were annual inspections, I think, that were completed in child care, for instance, and until I want to say sometime around 1993 or 1994, and there were some fairly severe budget issues involved, and at that time the Licensing Act was amended to allow licensing inspections every 2 years instead of every year, and that's where we've been since then, and we had a pretty significant reduction in the number of child care licensing staff at that time. You know, it's hard to know. The second part of your question, has that resulted in increased compliance problems and or maltreatment cases? You know, I wish we could answer that. I think the world was very different 18, 19 years ago than it is today, and many of the laws are much more clear now. Our sense is that, of course, being regulators, we think that, you know, the more we observe, the better the behavior. And so, you know, we believe that the longer interval between site inspections, there's some drift that occurs. So of course, we don't have any, you know, scientific evidence to show that. We didn't do a good study of anything when we decreased our site visits, unfortunately.
So. Thank you.
Well, thanks. I think we've grilled you enough for one day. I just want to remind members that the standards that are used by DHS and their licensing are standards we establish, and which is why they have to test them with court actions and appeals and sometimes repeals of our great intentions. I think Mr. Kerber has been a good steward of our efforts, and he'll be back again for another bill later, I think, this session. So
thanks, Mr.
Kerber. And then we have one more person from this group. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Joe. The last name is Jarris. It's spelled J-A-R. O-S is in Sam. Z is in zebra. And I supervise the parental fee unit at the Minnesota Department of Human Services. Legislation was enacted in 1967, which gave counties the authority to assess parental fees. That was under Minnesota Statute 252.27. Of course, many legislative changes have been made since that time, and current statute now requires the department to bill and assess parental fees. The families that are impacted by the fee assessments include parents whose children access Medicaid through TEFRA, which is also known as the Tax Equity and Fiscal Responsibility Act, HCBS waiver services, which are the home and community-based service waivers, and certain out-of-home placement arrangements that are funded by Medicaid. Parental income is not considered in the MA eligibility process for either TEFRA or HCBS. However, on the backside, that's where our agency comes into play, and we look at the parental income on the backside to see if the parents are required to pay a fee based on state statute. Fees are calculated using an income-based sliding fee scale that's defined in state statute. Some of the items that we're required to look at include the adjusted gross income from the federal tax forms for the parents, the household size, whether the child resides in the home with the parent, if the parent does reside in the home with the parent receives a $2,400 deduction off of their adjusted gross income. The amount of monthly court-ordered support payment for the child that's on MA. Again, this is another discount against the AGI prior to calculating the parental fee. And if the parent carries private health insurance for the child, there's not actually a discount that applies in that case, but rather a 5% penalty that's imposed if they do not have health insurance in place for the child, or if they elect to not cover the child under private insurance, if the cost would be less than 5% for that family. Excuse me. A few financial items. Over 10,000 accounts were established in state fiscal year 2010 for 8,100 children. The total collections for state fiscal year 2010 was $10.2 million. The state share of collections are deposited in the general fund as non-dedicated revenue. The parent fee that's owed will never be more than the cost of services that are consumed by the child during the fiscal year. Past due fees are referred to the department's collections unit, and then ultimately, if unpaid, referred out to the Minnesota Department of Revenue for them to attempt collection under Minnesota Statute 16D. That said, non-payment of the fee does not result in the child being removed from the program, and by that I mean medical assistance. And lastly, the parental fee unit consists of 5 full-time employees, including myself as supervisor. Any questions?
Well, and Prep Senator Lohmer and Mac, and who's on the waiver thing? I think that this would be part of I'm not sure who on the other side is. But whoever else is on that, this is a topic that would be certainly germane to your review. So we've established a study group of waivers and those kinds of services, which I'm not sure if it'd be healthcare or yours or this one, but I think the waivers would kind of be a compatible sort of a. So you might be getting a call from them to ask questions. Any questions about TEFRA? I think I'll just let those go for now. But Mr. Hayden, Representative Hayden.
I might have missed something in the. Do we know how much money, Ms. Chair, to testify? How much general fund money goes into the waiver programs? Are they? I missed the part about the match and how much the feds put in and how much we put in.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, I do not know that off the top of my head. Are you looking specifically for what's coming in from the feds into the waiver programs?
No, I'm more specifically looking at what, Mr. Chair, what we spend on the program.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, that I do not have that information.
Representative Hayden, he's in charge of the parental fee, you know, like the TEFRA, where we people with some income help pay for their. That's what this piece is about. We're doing waivers.
Oh, yeah, right. I'm just right. Trying to figure out the mix, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, well, Jarrus, is that?
Jarrus.
Yeah, yeah. Jarrus. People in TEFRA, are they on waivers?
Yeah.
Or would they would be in a waiver program or not?
Both, Mr. Chair. Both.
And, okay. Maybe you can just talk about maybe just tell us the difference. That'll maybe help us get at Representative Hayden's question and actually get the question I could have asked.
Mr. Chair, in both situations, under TEFRA and the HCBS waiver services, in both situations, the parental income is not deemed to the child at the time of MA application. Generally speaking, when a family comes in at the county level and applies for medical assistance, the county's going to take a look at the household income and essentially deem that income to the child at the time of application. I unfortunately don't know the threshold off the top of my head, but essentially if the family is below that threshold, they're going to qualify for what would be called straight medical assistance. And in that situation, the parents aren't going to be required to pay a parental fee. However, if their income is above that threshold, that's where there are a couple of different federal programs that are out there, TEFRA and the HCBS waiver services being the options, where the parental income does not have to be deemed to the child at the time of application. Rather, if the child is actually certified as disabled by the state medical review team or by the Social Security Administration, the child's disability status basically then allows the MA eligibility or becomes the basis for the MA eligibility. And those are the families that we look at as the parental fee unit as far as determining whether or not they have to pay a fee.
So, Mr. Chair, so would that, so then the dollars that I'm looking for from the general fund would just be administrative dollars? I would take it. It wouldn't, because the feds are paying, if they're deemed disabled, then the feds are paying the...
Mr. Charles.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, there's, being that the collections from parental fees are actually deposited as non-dedicated revenue into the general fund, the money that's collected in parental fees could realistically be used for anything. Specific to your question, unfortunately, that level of detail I don't have as supervisor of the parental fee unit.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is that helpful? I think that's anybody else on TEFRA? Thanks for being willing to talk to our members on as they have questions.
You're welcome.
And I think you're good to go. Are we through we're going to kind of go back to a topic we didn't quite finish yesterday. And if Mr. Reuter could come down. And we did kind of the, compared to today, we had a little more luxury of time. We just, we're interested, if you could help us understand enterprise services. And did you get a heads up of what we wanted to talk about? Okay.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I did.
So introduce yourself and...
Mr. Chair, I and members of the committee, my name is Tom Reuter, and I'm with the Chemical and Mental Health Administration. And yesterday you were provided a handout that looked very similar to this. You may have it in your packets today, you may not. On page 13 of that handout was a chart that looked like this. There's some terminology that we use within state-operated services to describe how our programs are financed, if you will. Some of the programs are financed through a direct state appropriation, and some of the programs bill and collect for services that are provided. We call those types of programs enterprise services because what they do is they operate in the marketplace very similar to how private providers operate in the marketplace for services that are provided. They're funded solely through the revenues that are collected from third-party payment sources. So those payment sources could be anything from medical assistance to billing a private health insurance plan for the services that are provided. And the types of services that are considered enterprise services are chemical addiction recovery enterprise programs, our child and adolescent behavioral health services programs, and the MSOX facilities, Minnesota State Operated Community Services programs that serve individuals, provide residential care for individuals with developmental disabilities, as well as the vocational programs that support those individuals as well.
And can you, are each of those breaking even as they're supposed to?
Are each of
those? Well, if they're supposed to pay their own way, how is that? How's that going for each of those different elements?
Those programs rely solely on the collections that they obtain, and so therefore, if they were not breaking even, we would be faced with making decisions about whether or not they should continue.
And I know the Brainerd Dental thing. Is that the one? Brainerd? Or was it Fergus? Or there was a Fergus. The Fergus Dental Project. Was that? That's one of those?
The dental
that was an issue last year, I think.
The dental clinics actually are not considered enterprise programs. They operate under a different set of language that we have. They're shared service language that we have in statute. They operate slightly differently. Historically, they relied upon the appropriation that was used to fund the regional treatment centers. Mm-hmm. And when the regional treatment centers closed, that funding disappeared to some extent. But we also utilize a billing method there to finance a portion of the operation of the dental clinics. So last year, the legislature passed a statutory change that allowed for a settle-up to occur because the cost of delivering the services to the individuals there is slightly higher than in the private marketplace.
As I recall, they had a very severely challenged populations to treat. Some were violent and had other challenges. And so is that operational and running as it was before, or were there some changes made in the operations of that?
Those programs continue to operate the way they are. The way they bill and collect for services are changed.
And there were three of those, right?
There's five dental five? Clinics.
And just tell us where they are, please.
They're located in Faribault, Cambridge, Fergus Falls, Wilmer, and then there's another clinic located in...
I know we didn't make you prepare for this, so it's okay.
and I should know this off the top of my head. Brainerd.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, I had a question about, is Lake Owosso residents included in state-operated services? Or since we don't have a chart or anything, it's hard to know exactly what's in and what's out.
I think it would be important for members to actually visit the department's website to get a clear history of state-operated services and the prior institutions that existed underneath what we now call state-operated services. If you go to the department's website, www.dhs.state.mn/SOS, in the first paragraph, there is a link to a document that will give you a historical context of all the previous institutions. Okay. Related to your question, Lake Owosso was part of the history of state-operated services. It was leased, I believe, from Ramsey County.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for our nice, very kind to come down to the table, random witness? Any questions about the fiscal management that we heard about today? Thank you very much, and thanks to the department staff for coming down and working with us. Out of respect for my predecessors, I had no idea how many meetings I have to balance, and people want to talk to me, and I have learned things about these topics that I didn't know. And so as we move forward as a committee, I hope that the members are not shy to get a hold of maybe Christine or the department legislative liaison with your things you wish you knew more about. The study groups are an effort to move us along, I'm sure a person in this committee 20 years would discover something new every year. So I hope these are helpful encounters with the department, and because actually now, see, since we are the policymakers for the state, we actually have to tell them how to run their departments, and they worked there 20 years. We've been here in, some cases not nearly as long as that. Okay, well, let's move to our house file of the day here. I'll move House File 128 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Right? Okay. And there are some witnesses. I have a few comments to make as the author of this bill. And then there'll be, with this kind of time, there's ample time for discussion, and then we'll be voting toward the end of our time in this hour. I put this in your, I'll just bring this up now. In your packets, there's an article I got out of the Pioneer Press talking about the battleground of U.S. debt. On the whole topic of balancing our budget, I spent some time talking to the some of the nonprofit groups this morning. And the short version of this article is that 41 cents on the dollar that the Fed send us is borrowed. And that's a new record, I think, or at least in the last couple of years, it's been a number in the 30s, and now it's at 41 cents. I think as we build our programs and transform them in some ways and restructure it to focus on the care for the people that we're attempting to serve, we have to keep in mind the capacity of those funding streams to remain flowing. And I've mentioned it before, and it just keeps popping up, even in our local papers, and substantive of articles that are well done by writers who have thought to write about it. And politics aside, and it's hard to do that in our work here, we are faced with a challenge that's bigger than anybody ever had, with less resources to draw on than we've had in the past. And I've been party to it as well. Oh, we can get federal match for something. Let's draw down the federal dollars and take care of our programs. Because that we now have, I think, some 29 Medicaid programs, and we have the counties will tell you that to get figure out how to apply for those and determine eligibility, it's hard to get the answer right. We tried to do health match, and we had the most complicated system in the country, or one of the most, and we spent a ton of money and couldn't get the job done. So, Representative Slaughter.
Mr. Chair, I just have a procedural question. I'm surprised you're chairing the meeting and presenting your bill. In our committees, at least when I chaired a committee, I would have someone else chair the committee so I could talk about the bill. And so typically that's what a chair does. I guess it's okay to do that, right? But it's harder for the committee to differentiate when you're being chair and when you're being author and so forth. Did you have any thought of that? It just strikes me as odd.
Well, I thought to stay here. There's no amendments. There'll be some discussion. It's my prerogative. Chair Huntley has done the same thing with some of his bills in the past. Well, this omnibus bill, he, I think, did it from the chair. So I think there's a custom, and I will certainly be as fair as I've ever been. If you want to talk about some elements of this, there'll be time for discussion. Okay. And that was my choice. So, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On a different but sort of related procedural topic, in my packet I have House File 1. Commonly, when we're going to vote on a bill, we have a copy of that bill, and I assume that even though I understand there's a relationship, is this the bill?
Actually, we're on House File 128, Representative Liebling, and that should be in your packet as well. It's much shorter.
Okay, and so you've got House File 1 here only for reference. Is that it's unusual to have a bill in our packets that is not the bill that we're voting on? I guess that's what I'm saying.
Well, thanks. I'm glad you brought that up. I'll work my way into that part of the chat as well. It's a bill you might find familiar. But, if the worst anybody says about me is I'm doing things unusually, this is a time to do things. We have a task unbeknownst to us previously, and so if we're going to attempt to solve it in a way that's going to do the good we want, I'm not afraid to do things a little differently. The bill before us is House File 128. And just to the point of Representative Liebling, thanks for bringing that up. All the subject matter in this bill was previously seen by the House. It was brought forward as part of, this is an author's exhibit, as House File 1. And if you're curious why I would put it there, some of the members are freshmen and didn't have a chance to see us previously on page, sorry, I can't read the numbers, 52, there's a piece of it on page 55, and on page 70 and 71, there's a piece of it, and the leadership at the time, I voted no on this bill, by the way, and I probably some of the dialogue we'll be having today are things I said on the floor saying why I didn't like House File 1. Interestingly, as an aside, out of the elements that were in this sheet of paper here, I have not received a call about any of these things, and not that they're not valuable services, and I can tell you why I think they're really important things that we have done in the past, but the leadership of last year, along with the governor, in a bipartisan way, overwhelming majorities of both houses, decided that these were changes that were suitable to be made at the time. And so in an effort to move some savings forward, they were okay then, and so we brought forward a package of five things that are identical to those as before. And so they really aren't even cuts anymore. They're carrying forward the previous levels of 2011. So that's why I gave you that bill, just so you could remember where these came from. I didn't sit up and didn't dream these up. So we do have some witnesses. Do you want to hear the witnesses first, or do you want to have some comments? Maybe we'll hear from the witnesses. Would that be appropriate? So we have three. We added one that wasn't on the list. Ms. Abderholden, if you'd like to come forward, that would be nice. And maybe Ms. Reagan, you can sit with her. And then Jessica Webster is on deck. Do you want to ask a question? Oh, yeah.
Well, I was just trying to follow your train of thought, if I may. So what you're saying is that you gave us House File 1 to make sure that those of us that were here jogged our memory that we voted for this, and so we should, because we voted for it at the time, we should look at it in the same context today as we did last year when we were in a different situation. I mean, I'm just trying to follow. I'm not trying to be facetious. I'm really just trying to follow your train of thought on that.
I'm Repson Hayden. I'm well aware it's a different day than it was last May. But I'm just brought this forward to help people remember where these items came from.
Oh, okay.
And I'm not going after motives. I'm just bringing forward a list that is a list that we've seen before. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just trying to understand.
I knew you'd be coming along. I woke up this morning at 5:30 knowing I'd be talking to you at this table today.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, for thinking of me at 5:30 this morning. I think I was thinking about you then, too. I just had one simple question. Are the cuts in House File 128 permanent cuts, Mr. Chair?
Representative Murphy, they're permanent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that would be a significant difference then from House File 1. Thank you.
Representative Murphy, that's why you're here, is to point out the differences, so thank you. And actually, do you want to, should we go through them, or are people well enough aware? Or should we watch the bill first? Testifiers there. Well, let's just do the testifiers. Welcome, Ms. Abderholden. How nice to see you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I'm Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. I'm actually going to have Ms. Regan go first, and we're here to, again, testify against the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mary Regan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Council of Child Caring Agencies, which is a statewide association of providers of treatment services for children and adolescents. And as Ms. Abderholden indicated, we are here in a bipartisan fashion to once again oppose the cuts proposed, especially to the Children and Community Services Act, referred to in the bill as CCSA. The Children and Community Services Act was created by the legislature in 2003 by combining 15 children and adult grants. At the time, children's grants were reduced by $50 million. Since then, further cuts have been made, including a one-time cut of $18.25 million last biennium. Today, the fund has a total of $63.8 million per year in base funding, which is allocated according to a formula to each county to serve the target populations, and those are children, adolescents, and adults who experience dependency, abuse, neglect, poverty, disability, and chronic health conditions. In reality, the majority of the dollars are spent on child protection to intervene and investigate in allegations of abuse and neglect. Unfortunately, I forgot to cite the source of my pie chart, so I can't hand it out to you, but it does indicate how the CCSA dollars are spent by counties. And on this chart, it shows that 72% of the dollars are spent on children, 56% on child protection, 16% on children's mental health, another 6% on adult mental health, 6% on detox chemical dependency services, and 16% on adult child protection. These are the only state dollars in Minnesota's child protection system. Minnesota puts fewer state dollars in child protection than any other state in the country. In this proposal, The CCSA grant is reduced by 30%, or $19.3 million per year. Investing allegations of abuse and neglect is a core function of government. No other sector of our society, not faith organizations, nonprofits, business, or any other entity, can take on this essential task. According to the Department of Human Services, the number of child fatalities or near fatalities has been rising since 2004. Between 2004 and the end of 2009, 89 children died and 180 suffered life-threatening injuries due to abuse or neglect. In 2009 alone, Minnesota counties and the Leech Lake and White Earth Bands of Ojibwe assessed 17,218 reports of maltreatment involving 24,499 children. This is the number of reports that were accepted. All counties have a screening system through which they decide which reports, those coming from daycare providers, from teachers, police officers, neighbors, and family members, which reports of abuse and neglect will be investigated. And some advocates, notably the citizens' advocacy group Safe Passages, are concerned about the growing gap between the number of calls to child protection and the number of allegations actually investigated. There is concern that as funding declines, the bar is being raised for what will be investigated. As a provider organization of services for children and families, many of whom have histories of abuse and neglect, we are so concerned about the declining funding available to counties to perform this essential task that we've been working on a proposal to dedicate all of the CCSA dollars to child protection, even though this could result in fewer mental health dollars for our members' services. Children who survive a chronic abuse and neglect come to see the world as a hostile place and can develop patterns of abusive behavior as a coping mechanism. They grow up to populate our prisons and are overrepresented in the group you heard about yesterday, civilly committed sex offenders who can't be released. To quote from a report from Every Child Matters, when provided with support services and appropriate supervision, the vast majority of potentially abusive and neglectful parents can learn to safely care for their children. And many abused children who get help are resilient enough to overcome their history. But for many, the outcome is predictable. When childhood goes wrong, adulthood goes wrong. And the sad story of abuse, including death, repeats itself from one generation of troubled families to the next. We recognize the budget challenges you have and know that counties are also facing deficits that are forcing them to make difficult decisions about their ability to respond even to these core functions. As the handout the chair passed out yesterday from the Anoka-Hennepin legislative delegation stated, we will do less with less. Please reconsider your decision to vote on this bill today. Please don't let your first vote in this committee, and your first vote as a new legislator potentially, be to cut the only state dollars that are used to intervene in child abuse and neglect. The message that these most vulnerable of our citizens are a priority and that these dollars will continue to be dedicated is important. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wiggin. Ms. Abderholden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I just wanted to echo the concerns that Ms. Regan has brought forward. Children who are in the end up in the child protection system have usually been exposed to trauma and actually do need to have mental health services, some of the very services that are paid for by these funds. You know, in 1976, we had $0 in our community mental health system. Zero. That was it. All we did was fund institutional care. We have never replaced really, you know, all of, in terms of the percentage of our budget, gone back in to develop those community services. Block grants that go to counties do help pay for people who are uninsured and underinsured so that they can actually access mental health services both as adults and with children. My concern with taking up this bill today is that it doesn't recognize the interconnectedness of all the other things that you're going to do. The personal care assistance cuts that go into effect on July 1st, we've been surveying families, and what we found is there's actually quite a few parents who live with a mental illness whose children also have some type of disability who use the PCA service to really keep their families together and keep them together well. That's going to go away on July 1st, and so what do those families do? And I think some of them will end up, frankly, in the child protection system. You know, other changes that may come down the pike as well, as you kind of put the whole budget together, they all are interconnected. So if you cut, you know, last year when you funded the General Assistance Medical Care Program, you took away $11 million for adult mental health. That has an impact in terms of how people access it. I have always been of the rule that if the bus hits you, you need to scream, it'll turn around and hit you again. So I'm here once again to tell you that the bus is hitting, that, you know, these services, while it may not seem like a lot in the whole, you know, pie, it's still a lot of funding for mental health services that are already very much underfunded. So I appreciate your time today.
Ms. Abderholden, thank you, and please keep letting us know. Thank you. Now if Jessica Webster would please come.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, if I may I share my 2 minutes with my colleague Patrick Ness from the Coalition for the Homeless?
Hello, welcome. You can actually each have 2 minutes.
All right, fantastic. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jessica Webster. I'm a staff attorney with Legal Aid. Legal Aid provides free legal services to low-income people across Minnesota. And what I'd like to reference today is Legal Aid's opposition to the bill, namely because of line 2.22 and line 2.27. And this is what's known as emergency general assistance and emergency Minnesota supplemental aid. Mr. Chair and members, one of the things that's frustrating, I think, as an advocate is when we get these pieces of legislation is it's just... There's nothing here about who the people are that are eligible for these services. So it's easy to see these services in three or four words, but you don't have the eligibility criteria. So what I'd like to do is to just take a minute to reference 256D in Minnesota statutes, and that discusses who's eligible for these programs. And there, you know, there's 14 categories of eligibility. I'm only going to go through a handful of them. So who receives this emergency assistance? It's temporary, it's emergency assistance. Low-income people who are sick, low-income people who have serious injuries, poor people who have ill or injured children, battered women who are in battered women's shelters, people living in homeless shelters, homeless youth, displaced homemakers, the developmentally disabled, people who are low IQ, people who are mentally ill. All of these people are unable to work because of these categories that makes them eligible. People who are elderly and who their advanced age makes them unable to work. People who, based on a vocational rehabilitation assessment, are found to be unemployable. And people who are in protective court-ordered services that are unable to work while they're in this protective service. So these are the people, the parents, the families who are eligible for these tiny amounts of assistance when they face an emergency. And those emergencies can spiral out of control to be much more significant emergencies when they're not assisted. I also, I don't have it here to pass out, but these are not just urban services. Every legislator around the table here today has constituents that are eligible for these services. I have by county the constituents who are in general assistance and also receive Minnesota supplemental aid. So if you're interested in how many constituents you have who may be eligible at a time of emergency, I'd be happy to share that with you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for coming. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Patrick Ness with the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. We are a coalition of about 150 service providers spanning the state of Minnesota. Our mission is to end homelessness in Minnesota. At the time that I was born, homelessness was hardly perceptible. And just in the last 3 years now, we've seen a 27% increase in homelessness. We at the Coalition and our members oppose these cuts to emergency general assistance and the emergency Minnesota supplemental aid, plain and simple, because it will increase homelessness. Costs will be shifted to local governments. We are busting at the seams with our both our private and public safety net, and this is these are very, very sick and very, very poor people. And I would just echo the last testimony that we would prefer that these cuts will be made in a more comprehensive fashion. And when you pull on kind of when you pull on one side, especially dealing with people living in poverty, it can kind of be a house of cards. And this is an important safety net. It's smart, targeted investment, and I ask that you consider opposing these cuts. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Mr. Ness. Thanks for coming down. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am sorry the testifiers just kind of left there, but I think the issue that we're seeing here somewhat is that these folks having genuine needs, but over the last year or so, what this bill does is just maintain. So what was done in the last year is would be just continuing. So I just thought that, you know, you hear some of these phrases and stuff. And I think, too, the comment that I heard before about the difference in this bill is that it's permanent versus temporary. My opinion is that I think that's exactly the issue. Because what happens is that what we do is we make spending permanent, and then when we have the maintenance or other issues like that, those are temporary, then you have this big bounce back. And so we end up with these huge structural year upon year upon year. I mean, you will never, ever get the budget dealt with if you don't deal with some of those structural things. We've talked about that, remember, the last 2 years, the structural issues, but both based upon it that when we have a surplus, then spending zooms up and it's permanent, and then we're committed to that, and people have expectations, and as we all know, those things are usually only temporary, wonderful good times, and then you do have the lean years that follow almost rather predictably. We don't know exactly when. So I think actually, you know, we see kind of a philosophy here that we want to make sure that we work at reform and restructuring, not that needs don't get met, but they may be met in a different way or in a coordinated way or a renewed way or a reformed way, but that there are certainly valid needs, but they don't always have to be met in that same way. And I think we miss those opportunities then to do some of those structural things. So I think what this one is doing is just setting a basis of ongoing and continuing as was done last year and going forward, but looking forward to doing some effort on structural and then also, I think we've all talked about it, some reform, avoiding some duplications, combining those kinds of things, and those are valid. But this is just one piece of that effort.
Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a lot that I'd like to say. First one is I'm disappointed with the way that this has come up. First, just to kind of gather a little bit of perspective, one, this bill is not the same as what was in the special session bill of last year. And Representative Kiffmeyer, the emergency general assistance and the MSA were backfilled by federal dollars. Completely different. And that was something that the governor proposed. The child support enforcement grants, backfilled by federal dollars. So those cuts weren't realized or weren't seen or weren't impacting the counties or the individuals most affected by them. Mr. Chair, this bill was introduced at 3 o'clock yesterday on the House floor. Your own committee rules requires handouts to have a 24-hour period submitted for you just to hand out at this committee. This committee has 8 members that have not served on this committee before. I think it would be a challenge to have those 8 members to be able to even identify the acronyms in this bill with MSA, CCSA, GA, and what they mean. It's just a frustrating circumstance to be in. Another difference of this bill, and actually this was brought up by Representative McDonald last week, was his frustration that his hospitals and providers aren't getting the same reimbursements. Well, this bill is going to exacerbate that. Primary care is impacted by the reimbursement cuts in this bill. That was not included in the last legislation. Primary care was excluded from those reimbursement cuts. Significant differences. And that's going to exacerbate problems that have already been identified by members of this committee. And the CCSA grants, we need to remember who are being impacted by the CCSA grants. These are most vulnerable children. Children who have experienced neglect, physical abuse, and sexual abuse. And right now, according to the Department of Human Services, by the Child Welfare Disparities Report, only 60% of reports are investigated in a timely fashion. Will this bill help that? Probably not. Lastly, I can't remember a single time that we've passed a bill out of this committee that has not had a fiscal note. I do not see a fiscal note here anywhere, Mr. Chair. And, you know, we can look at just some of the total numbers on the backside, but we don't even know what the reimbursement cuts, what that totals. Or it hasn't been presented to the committee members, at least. So with that said, Mr. Chair, I would like to move that we table this bill and address this in another day where we have more time.
Okay, that's not a debatable motion. Do the members understand the motion, especially the freshmen? Do you understand? A green vote, a yes vote would suspend action should that prevail. A green vote is to suspend action on the bill to some time later, and a no vote is to continue action on the bill.
Mr. Chair, I'd like a roll call.
Roll call being requested. Is Andy, you set up?
Representative Abler.
No.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
No.
Representative Anderson.
No. No.
Representative Franson.
No.
Representative Fritz.
Yes.
Representative Gottwalt.
No.
Representative Hamilton is excused. Representative Hayden.
Yes.
Representative Hosh.
Yes.
Representative Huntley.
Yes.
Representative Lane excused. Representative Lanning.
No.
Representative Liebling.
Yes.
Representative Lohmer.
No.
Representative Mack.
No.
Representative McDonald.
No.
Representative Michelfatrick.
No.
Representative Murphy.
Yep.
Representative Schumacher.
No.
Representative Slawick.
Yes.
Seven ayes and 11 nays.
Okay, the motion does not prevail. Just Representative Hosh, for your technical advice, the language on page one is identical to the language of House File 1, except that it was changed to become permanent. The inclusion or exclusion of various providers is the same as it was, just for that point of information. Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think Representative Hosh said a lot of what I wanted to say and much better, I think, than I could have said it. I was going to ask, really ask the question about whether these cuts, in fact, were just straight cuts in the last budget, as Representative Kiffmeyer was talking about, and Representative Hosh said that those were backfilled by federal money, which was my understanding as well, and I was going to actually ask the previous testifiers to answer that question, or maybe somebody else can answer that question about the backfilling of these funds, because I think that's a very important issue, whether in fact our state's been simply functioning without these monies for the last couple of years, or if in fact these funds were being provided from another source.
Maybe Mr. Wallace could answer that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, in regards to Representative Hosh's comments, I remember that we did receive some federal money for child care providers. The number escapes me, but I believe it was somewhere in the neighborhood of $17 million to backfill cuts that were made by the legislature. In regards to any backfilling for GA or MSA, that escapes me right now. I would have to go double check, but I don't remember any specifics for those two programs.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Walz. Mr. Chair, well, we have folks from the counties here, and maybe they could be asked this question since they're the ones who administer these.
Actually, maybe Ms. Rankin could. Do you know that, Ms. Rankin? Right, yeah. Come up. The department can answer that for us.
Mr. Chair and members, Jane Rankin, the budget director at DHS. I was looking for my documents about stimulus funding, and I don't seem to have the folder with me, but I think that what Representative Hosh was referring to is that in the fiscal 10-11 biennium, there are stimulus funds available, and one of the areas is in child support enforcement. Another area is in emergency assistance. This is through the TANF increased funding there. And that second piece is not exactly the same, I think, as EGA and EMSA. But I do recall that it would have been 2 years ago when the legislature was appropriating the increased TANF money, that some of the direction to the county was to use it in ways that are similar to the EGA and EMSA program. So I believe that is a connection there to what Representative Hosh had mentioned.
Questions from Ms. Rankin? Thank you. Representative Huntley, thank you for coming down.
Mr. Chair, I would move that we delete Section 1 and ask for a roll call.
Okay, do you want to talk about your motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. This section relates directly to primary care providers. It does not extend an ongoing cut, but adds a cut to people that haven't been getting it. So this is a new cut, and it undermines reform. It applies only to primary care physicians, does not apply to all physicians. Last year, we learned from the MMA that Minnesota was ranked 47th in the reimbursement to primary care providers. We exempted them from any cuts last year as an attempt to correct that problem. This section of the bill would undo that. I would say it also undoes reform. There's a direct correlation between the number of primary care physicians in a state per population and the high quality and low cost. The more primary care docs you have, the higher the quality, the lower the cost. North Dakota is number one in that ranking. Minnesota is number two. You can find, if you correlate a direct opposite, the more specialists you have per population, the lower the quality and the higher the cost. So this section goes to undo that correlation. We are the only country in the civilized world that pays specialists significantly more than primary care docs. Every other country pays primary care docs about the same as specialists. In this country, we pay primary care docs about $160,000 a year. We pay orthopedics and radiology about $400,000 a year, and we pay neurosurgeons about $1 million a year. And that says more than what we're paying them. It says what we value. And under our current system, which we attempted to correct last year, under our current system, we do not value primary care. There's been a 60% drop over the last 8 years in the number of U.S. medical school grads going into primary care. A 60% drop. Why is that? Again, it's the reimbursement rates that we pay these people and the salaries they can make. Under Governor Pawlenty's Transformation Task Force in 2008, we had a major emphasis on chronic disease management, got us a lot of national attention. Chronic disease management is done by primary care docs. It is not done by specialists. So, if you vote against this, my amendment, you are voting for a specific cut on primary care docs and no other physicians. I urge you to vote yes for my amendment.
Thanks, Epson Huntley. I just want to point out that the language, I don't agree with your assessment of the piece, and you get the privilege of having your own opinion, but the language is taken exactly out of House File 1, page 70, and the exclusions and the exceptions are identical to what was there. I appreciate your enthusiasm for not liking provider cuts. I haven't liked them either in the past, but this is the identical piece that we did in House File 1. I'm just telling you that that's the case. Roll call being requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Representative Abler.
No.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
No.
Representative Anderson.
No.
Representative Franson.
No.
Representative Fritz.
Yes.
Representative Gottwalt.
No.
Representative Hamilton is excused. Representative Hayden.
Yes.
Representative Hosh.
Yes.
Representative Huntley.
Yes.
Representative Lane is excused. Representative Lanning.
No.
Representative Liebling.
Yes.
Representative Lohmer.
No.
Representative Mack.
No.
Representative McDonald.
No.
Representative Meckel-Fatrick.
No.
Representative Murphy.
Yes.
Representative Schumacher.
No.
Representative Slawik.
Yes.
No.
7 ayes, 11 nays.
The motion does not prevail. Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm inclined to make a motion myself, but I think I'm going to not do that today. But I do want to talk a little bit about the child support enforcement grants, and just kind of for our new members and others. I think that in the series of cuts that we're going to have to make, I anticipate that there'll be a lot of talk about our MFIP program, which to a lot of people they call it the welfare program. And one of the things that happens is that we will look to cut or change the way in which you we assist families that really need our help, that are kind of at the end of their rope. And one of the ways in which we keep families off of the MFIP program is through collecting child support from a non-custodial parent. So what that means for folks is that when the person who is not taking care of the child, the other parent, that could be the mother or the father, is not in the household, we then go out and seek to find that person and figure out if they are indeed the parent, the non-custodial parent, and then we assess their income versus the parent, the custodial parent's income, and then they pay each and every month. And I know a lot of people, we know what child support is, but that is one of the primary ways in keeping people off of the Minnesota Family Investment Program, or what some call welfare. And so I want us to be thoughtful and mindful as we get into the nitty-gritty of this debate over the next couple of months about welfare, that the cuts that we're making here are driving families to the welfare system. They're driving families to the Minnesota Family Investment Program. And so we can't have it both ways. So if we're going to cut the enforcement of making sure that parents are paying to take care of their child, then we should see the increase see the increased number of parents looking for us to help them, because those parents will not be found.
And so that's a little bit of an opposite of an argument that I often make to do that. But I think for the new members and others, I think we need to think deeply. I think, you know, this is kind of a novel way of saying, hey, these cuts were here before, and let's hurry up and get this, you know, out the gate. But I do agree, and Mr. Chair, you know, with all due respect, I think we got to really, really think about what we're doing here. At the end of the day, we are going to have to make some cuts. We all know that, regardless to who proposal gets through. But I think to kind of rush these cuts in and then use this idea that, oh, you've done this before, I don't think that that's the way in which we should do it if we really want to be thoughtful. Mr. Chair, you have given us some tasks, some homework. You've paired us up to work together to look at approaches that may work, to see if we can find some bipartisan agreement on this. And I frankly don't believe that going down this road and kind of picking things out and saying that this is what we're going to do this early in the process, if I'm just looking at the way in which you've set the committee up, is the right way to go. So I guess I've said two things. One, I disagree with the bill. I disagree in the way that you're going about it, frankly. But I also really want us to think about what we're doing here and that how are we supposed to find innovation or reform if we are indeed taking those tools away from us before we get started. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I appreciate your thoughtful comments. Representative Murphy, you get the last word, then we're going
to
vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate it. It's good to have a run. In my county, this is going to cause a cost shift to the county, and the property taxpayers are going to pick up $4 million. In Dakota County, it's $1.2 million. In Douglas County, $136,000 is going to be picked up by the property taxpayers. In Stearns County, $614,000 will be picked up by the property taxpayers. In Clay County, $300,000 will be picked up by the property taxpayers. That is, of course, unless you're suggesting to the counties and to the people of Minnesota that child protection is no longer a priority for this committee. I don't support that. I'm not going to vote for this. I'm not in favor of these unfunded mandates to the counties, and I think we shouldn't be doing this today. Thank you.
Well, members, I appreciate the discussion.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'd like to request a roll call on the vote,
certainly,
please.
So I'll just offer my final author's comments now, and then we'll move to the vote. And I appreciate the thoughtful discussion we've had today. I don't know if this particular list of topics is going to become law or not. And with all respect to those who voted for House File 1, I didn't like it then either, and a lot of you don't like it now. You didn't like it then, and I didn't ever say you liked it. This is how we budget sometimes around here. And what I've set up in place, this is a drop in the ocean for the numbers. And we in this committee have the authority to work on all these topics further, should this become law. So I want to remind members that maybe it's a call to action to be alert, to re-engage, and to transform. But I hope at the end of the day, when we get a bill passed the governor's going to sign, that we will come out and be as happy as we can be with what's there. So the topic before us today is House File 128, and the clerk will take the roll.
Representative Abler.
Yes.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Yes.
Representative Anderson.
Yes.
Representative Franson. Representative Fritz.
No.
Representative Gottwalt.
Yes.
Representative Hamilton is excused. Representative Hayden.
No.
Representative Hosh.
No.
Representative Huntley.
No.
Representative Lane is excused. Representative Lanning.
Yes.
Representative Liebling.
No.
Representative Lohmer.
Yes.
Representative Mack.
Yes.
Representative McDonald.
Yes.
Representative McElfatrick.
Yes.
Representative Murphy.
Heck no.
Representative Schumacher.
Yes.
Representative Slawick.
No.
11 ayes, 7 nays.
With the motion passes, the motion prevails. The bill is passed and re-referred to Ways and Means. Tomorrow we're going to get back to work on our topics. We're adjourned.